We'll call the Senate Transportation Finance and Policy Committee to order for March 13th. And first up on our agenda is Senator Senjum with Senate File 1063.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1063, and I'll be very brief. It's an idea that has come to me from a near and dear constituent. It has to do with something that Senator Perry and I are well familiar with, and that's Highway 14. But perhaps few people that are aware of Highway 14 are aware that at some point back in history it was known as the Black and Yellow Trail. And this would propose to designate Highway 14 going through the state of Minnesota as the Black and Yellow Trail. And without further ado, I would like to call on my witness, Ray Ricketts, to explain a little bit about this and what the mystery of the Black and Yellow Trail might be. And we can take some questions, and we'll try to be brief.
Mr. Ricketts, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ray Ricketts. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. And I thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my experience and my feelings on this topic. In the summer of 2005, when my wife and I were working in Yellowstone Park, we were researching information on the park's ghost hotels at the Yellowstone Heritage Center in Gardner. And I ran across an article about the early highway from Chicago to Yellowstone called the Black and Yellow Trail. In 1912, the Yellowstone Trail Association was formed with the intent of creating an auto route from the east into Yellowstone Park. And over the next several years, planning and pressure forced this route well beyond Yellowstone, and it finally became known as the Boston to Puget Sound Route. That same year, a second group was formed to develop a parallel route into Yellowstone, and this Chicago to Black Hills to Yellowstone route became shortened to the Black and Yellow Trail. Building this route across Wisconsin, Minnesota, South Dakota, and Wyoming began in 1913, with many unconnected segments built as funding became available. An early Montana auto map shows these segments running piecemeal from La Crescent to Winona, Rochester, Owatonna, Mankato, and West. The final portion of the trail was constructed, as noted on the May 22, 1917 article in the Mankato Free Press, that the Yellow Trail is nearly finished. And that article states, and I quote, "The longest direct gravel road in Minnesota will be fully completed and carrying heavy traffic by midsummer." On September 15, 1917, Charles Babcock, the Minnesota Commissioner of Highways, issued Order Number 139, and I again quote, "duly authorizing the Black and Yellow Trail to be registered in the Highway Department and designating the signage to be used in marking said highway as a trail." In 1920, Minnesota voters approved a constitutional amendment creating the Minnesota Trunk Highway System, and the Black and Yellow Trail became known as Minnesota Trunk Highway 7. Several years later, when the U.S. government created the U.S. Highway System, that Minnesota 7 became known what today we know as Minnesota 14, or as U.S. 14. In 1923, a national Black and Yellow Trail organization was formed in Huron, South Dakota, recognizing, supporting, and promoting the final completion of the trail over the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming with a road wide enough that two cars can pass at any point. It was promoted as a scenic and safe route, and that motto continues today as you travel I-90 near Buffalo, Wyoming. Nearly 120 towns along the trail were encouraged to offer the traveler free camping and rest stop facilities, and I found that many of those facilities still exist in small towns in South Dakota and Minnesota. I believe that we should honor the order written by Charles M. Babcock and recognize the route across Minnesota as he stated. This is a piece of our state's history that still closely follows its original alignment. Segments follow the original trail in the vicinity of Stockton, Lewiston, St. Charles, and Iota, and Highway 14 is within feet of the old alignment. The route from Dodge Center to Havana appears to be the original route. And from Mankato west to Lake Benton, there are parts of the present Highway 14 that are either the original trail or within a few feet of it. Today in South Dakota, between Pier and Wall, there are stretches of Highway 14 where I've seen the abandoned highway bridges, and I found one old abutment that still has the black, yellow, and black markings that designate that original trail. My request to you is that we simply note Highway 14 at the east and west Minnesota state lines as the route of the Black and Yellow Trail, and do it similarly at the intersection of Highway 14 and I-35 near Owatonna. I do not wish to compete with the Laura Ingalls Wilder route. In fact, I've spoken with the executive director and several museum managers to outline my request and let them know that I'm not trying to usurp their identification, and their replies to me have supported what I'm proposing. I've also contacted the executive directors of several of the historical societies within the state, as well as representatives of the Minnesota River Valley National Scenic Byway, and they have also expressed encouragement for this effort and are interested in our outcome. Can they help with funding and installation of signage? To be honest, all county societies are operating on a very tight budget, as is our state. I can only hope that this does not deter this panel and the legislature from considering and supporting my request on its historical merits. I've given you all copies of the article I wrote on the Black and Yellow Trail for the Olmsted County History Center in 2007 and a copy of the order signed by Charles Babcock in 1917. I also have maps of the old trail route as well as ones from 1920 when the Minnesota highway system was established. I want to thank you for your time and your interest and ask if there are any questions.
Any questions from the committee?
And, Mr. Chair, can I just add, I think, as perhaps was clear, we're here today looking for a designation. If this were designated in statute as a Black and Yellow Trail, we and others will have to worry about signage and finding resources for that.
Thank you, Senator Sundrum. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ricketts, I just wanted to thank you for coming and for sharing your article with us. I was just quickly reading it while you were testifying and look forward to reading it a little bit more slowly later on. It's really interesting. Thank you.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too was reading it. It's fascinating. My question is, are there any other parts of Highway 14? It's the whole length of it from state border to state border. Any other portions of Highway 14 that have been previously designated? And I know you mentioned Laura Ingalls Wilder, but I was wondering if there's any conflict in doing that, or can routes have, state highways have more than one designation? I know sometimes they'll have a designation for just a stretch of highway as a memorial to a police officer or someone, but is that the case with Highway 14, or is there no designation anywhere along the line? And maybe Senator Perry or Senator Sinjum, maybe you know, or maybe Ms. Berezovsky knows. Just a question.
Senator Perry, Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. Unless Senator Sinjum knows something different, but I travel it quite a bit, and I don't believe so.
Senator Rest, you bring up a good point. Can there be overlapping designations?
I'm just curious. Maybe the department would know if somewhere along that route there's an overlapping designation. There would be.
Mr. Rudin is here. Maybe give us some input.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, in the immediate, maybe 40 or 50 miles either side of Rochester, it is not otherwise designated, insofar as I recall.
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Office of Government Affairs, and the western portion of this highway is already designated as the Laura Ingalls Wilder Memorial Highway. The highway portions of it are also designated as the Pioneer Trail. However, that's a very old designation, and there are not currently any signs marking it as the Pioneer Trail. There are some signs marking it as the Laura Ingalls Wilder Highway. To understand that the sponsor has been in touch with that group, and they don't have an objection to the dual designation, but to my knowledge, it would be the first section of highway that has multiple designations and is signed as multiple designations.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rudin, would the department have any objection to that dual designation? I mean, we're not going to litter the highway with with signs, obviously. I think that's really clear. But is there otherwise, is there any problem with it? Because I think this is a great idea.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, it would be a concern if we had competing signs. We think that could cause confusion for the driving public, but it sounds in this case like the black and yellow sponsors just want very limited signage in a couple of locations, and we think we'll be able to reach a compromise between the two groups. And some.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Senjum, what we will do is lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it very much.
And also, thank you, Senator.
Thank you for being here. Next up is Senator Peterson with Senate File 2243. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for the chance to come and present Senate File 2243 to you this afternoon. This bill relates specifically to public-private partnerships, is an acronym, or PPPs that you may have heard of in the transportation industry, which would allow the Department of Transportation and to enter into just that, a public-private partnership that would, in theory, allow private companies to come into the state of Minnesota and build large projects that have not been able to be accomplished to date for a number of reasons, funding reasons potentially. And so where we originally got this idea is a project up in central Minnesota. There's a project that relates specifically to a high-speed river crossing that's in the neighborhood of $150 million project where much of the environmental work has been done, some of the right-of-way work has been done as far as the neighborhood and properties that are in that area. And what this bill would allow the DOT to enter into an agreement that would allow a private equity firm to come in, build that project, potentially charge a toll, have a toll road. But in this particular case, there still would be a free route around this high-speed river crossing, so to speak, moving west to Highway 94, crossing at Clearwater to Clear Lake over the Mississippi, and then north onto Highway 10. And so that's kind of the project we had in mind specifically for this type of partnership. This bill would establish the ability to the Department of Transportation to enter into that type of agreement, which they cannot do now. And have some folks that have been willing to come down and testify in favor of this bill.
This is a very interesting and exciting approach, actually, if we can get this moving forward. I know you've done a lot of work, and the partners out there have done a lot of work to,
Mr. Chair,
put together the pieces of this. And, you know, good to see this thing, this approach move forward and at least have this discussion on it. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Peterson, this is a route that I take on a weekly basis back up to the Brainerd Lakes area. It's about a three-mile stretch from 94 to cut over on 24 to 10. And so you're saying the present route would remain there and this would be an additional route. Is that correct?
Senator Peterson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, that is correct. The idea behind this high-speed river crossing, it would exit I-94 moving west, just I would call south or east of Clearwater, move off to the right or to the east, cross the river at interstate speed, and then land on Highway 10 north or I guess west of Clear Lake. Potentially is the project that's been planned and has been envisioned in that process, but it still would allow the existing route that would not be impaired at all.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up question. So the private company would build it, then the tolls would be collected if people wanted to go that route because they wouldn't have to. The tolls, would that then go to the private company, or would it be split with the state, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, how we would envision this is that, yes, the private equity company would come in and build it. My preference, and we're still doing research on this, my preference would be have just a capital company that would look for a competitive road bid. I would rather not see a capital company that also does road construction. I would like to see a separate capital investment company that will hire and go to competitive bid with existing road contractors, build the project. We would have the Department of Transportation, in theory, would have an agreed upon return that would be they would be allowed to get, you know, for in their investment in building this project. And then once that return is met, then the project would be turned back over to the taxpayers.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson, I see in your bill that there it does give the commissioner discretion to build, build, operate, and transfer, or build, build and operate. Right? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, I did have some amendments or suggestions that we had gotten from the Department of Transportation, and we may have not gotten those to the proper staff. I see a head shaking, so. I will have to address that moving forward in terms of the suggestions at the Department of Transportation. If they're here, they may be willing to talk to those suggestions. I think there was three or four concerns that they had and ideas that came out of a task group that worked on private-public partnerships and which I agreed to and had given the assurance that I'd have amendments for you, and I failed in that to have that completed today. So.
I see the department is here. Would somebody be willing to come up and talk to those amendments, just so we have a briefing on them when we get to the point where we're going to move this bill? Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Peterson with the Office of Government Affairs at MnDOT. Yes, as Senator Peterson stated, he did give us an opportunity to comment on this bill, and our comments largely were focused on some of the work that was done by a task force that was created last year by the department to look at these types of arrangements and how they could be, tailored to work well within the culture and the legal framework that exists in the state of Minnesota. And I believe Senator Dibble was actually a part of that task force, and you know, I'd invite him to weigh in on this, too, if he feels so inclined. But that task force, they had two key recommendations, I think, that would apply to this legislation. One is that there be some kind of independent oversight group established to help give the public confidence that an arrangement of this nature actually serves the public interest and that the public interest is well protected by the agreement that's reached between the private entities and the Department of Transportation. And I don't have the details of what that, any suggestions about what that group would look like, but it was basically to, again, ensure or give the public confidence that this arrangement did protect the public interest adequately. And then the other piece that was recommended by that task force was that there be also an independent, what's called a value for money analysis, which does a thorough financial evaluation of the proposed agreement, again, to ensure that the public interest is well protected, that the benefits, financial benefits in particular, that go to the private investment firm and all the other private companies involved were consistent with the risk that they were taking and the benefits that they were providing to the public. And then beyond that, we just had a couple of other, I think, kind of relatively small comments on line 1.2, line A, where it says the commissioner may not receive, consider, evaluate, or accept unsolicited proposals. We suggested that maybe that could just be limited to the commissioner may not accept unsolicited proposals. Because we do get proposals brought to us on occasion, and it is helpful to be able to look those over and see if there are seeds of a good proposal in there. And it would be our intent, though, that in every instance, then those before any agreement would be reached, we would go out for a competitive to a competitive process to determine which private companies we'd actually enter into an agreement with. And then on B, kind of along the similar veins there, you know, we suggested maybe just dropping to on line 1.23 to the maximum extent possible so that it was a little stronger in the assurance that it would actually be done on a competitive basis. And I think really that was kind of the bulk of our comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I think that helps us as we, because we are going to be moving this bill to the State Government and Innovation Committee. It helps us a little bit in understanding the amendments that I would have presumed you'll be adding on at that point in time. And State Gov, is that correct, Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, yep, that's correct. I would add those on in State Government. The other two issues that have been brought to my attention by the Minnesota Trucking Association as well, they would have concern that this would just be on new projects, which was our intent of the bill, and that also that it would be just, it would not be used, capital investment company would not be used to work on existing infrastructure, so it would be a vehicle or a mechanism to bring new projects and expand our transportation system rather than take care of the one that that we already have, so to speak. So that would be the only other two issues I would need to make sure are clarified. So,
any other questions from the committee, Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I can wait until Mr. Weiser is. 5 minutes. Had a couple of kind of a benediction to the State Government Committee and.
Mr. Weishaar.
Because I haven't prepared amendments myself. So.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. I am speaking in behalf or in favor of Senator Peterson's bill, and a couple of things introductory-wise. My name is Doug Weishaar. I am a vice president with WSB & Associates, an engineering firm here in Minnesota. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Central Minnesota Transportation Alliance, a group of businesses and government in the St. Cloud area who are banded together to work towards transportation improvements that enhance the economic environment of our state and region. I'm also here on behalf of ACEC Minnesota, the Consultant Engineers Coalition, and speaking again on behalf of this bill. The bill is, in our mind, one additional way for us to move transportation projects which have not had an opportunity to move forward because of our financial limitations here in the past. Senator Peterson talked about the one in the St. Cloud area that we think is a candidate. I'm not sure whether the department has that at the top of its list, given the ability, but it certainly would be on the list, I believe. This project is, in total, a project that would cost about $240 million, and that would include the construction that Senator Peterson referred to, but also right-of-way acquisition, engineering, other contingencies that have to take place, utility relocations, et cetera. I do want to point out that the department and the utility companies had the foresight to plan for this project when they located the CapEx utility project through that area. So congratulations, Mr. Peterson, on that fabulous foresight. But the project in itself has entirely passed through the environmental process. So it has a record of decision, a staff-approved layout. It is ready to go, save for the fact it has no money. We feel in St. Cloud that this would enhance our economic situation. I know that Senator Peterson and I have talked about this in the past and how the trucking industry and also other industries within our community would greatly be enhanced and be able to do expansion, et cetera, should a project like this be in place. There are many others across the state that I know we could enumerate, and I'm sure that the department could give you a list should that come to pass. But we have a lot of needs in our state, needs that would help us grow our economy, produce jobs, We just need an additional tool to help us gain the financial wherewithal to make it happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and as long as Senator Peterson confessed, I'll confess. He did approach me about this bill, and I promised I'd review it, and I'm just reviewing it now on the fly here. got a little bit away from me. But, you know, I'm glad we're having this discussion, and I'm glad that Senator Peterson is bringing forward the idea of public-private partnerships. They're an important tool in the tool bag. They're not the certainly not going to be the thing that saves us from our capacity and construction but you know, particularly with large projects, you know, it perhaps allows us to get to some that otherwise we wouldn't get to for a long, long time. But I just wanted to share a little bit about you know, what some of the things to keep in mind and to think about as we step into this realm of PPPs in Minnesota. Part of what I know is based on having worked with the National Conference of State Legislatures, had a PPP study group for a couple of years that I served on. So I went from being dubious and skeptical and kind of opposed to actively interested. And so I learned a lot. Probably the biggest pitfall that other states have stepped into are exactly what John Houseladen raised, which is taking existing infrastructure and privatizing it and really antagonizing and then losing control of the ownership and accountability piece and losing control of the tolls that are charged and the quality of the ongoing maintenance and operation of that facility. Probably the best example is the elevated freeway in Chicago called the Skyway. And they took a big chunk of money and then kind of turned it over to a private entity and spent, you know, and then dumped all that money in the general fund. It was lost to transportation purposes and lost control of that facility, and it was pretty bad, but that's not what we're contemplating here. The other is just making sure that, you know, as we're contemplating new projects, we're not displacing other projects. That's the infamous queue jumping that folks get really anxious about if they feel like their project somehow has fallen further down on a list because there are some big dollars available to build this project. It's just something to keep an eye on. I think I read a protection against that in the bill. Probably the most important thing, kind of early test that comes to states that start with PPPs is the risk transfer piece. That's probably the greatest power in the idea of a PPP is transferring risk to the entity that's going to be building. You know, so there, you know, risk around time, risk around cost, that sort of thing. You know, you agree up front, you know, what risk do you take on and what risk do we retain? And often, there comes a test in how firm is the state going to hold on that whole risk transfer piece. If private entity takes on that risk, then if they miscalculate the risk, that's not the state's problem. And when states kind of knuckle under the pressure that might come back because the private entity didn't quite calculate their risk the way they anticipated they should have, and they come back and they want additional consideration, it's very important for states to hold firm, or else you've just lost the value of having entered into a PPP. The ownership piece is very dicey. I highly advise that we not transfer ownership of the facility to a private entity. That just publicly and politically, that doesn't, and in terms of public accountability, that presents a lot of money. Mr. Peterson already hit on the value for money analysis, kind of the objective analysis by an advisory group or a disinterested party to really let the public know and let the agency know that we are getting the kind of value that we're looking for. A big concern are labor considerations. We need to make sure that all the stakeholders are at the table. I don't see any provisions for labor, for prevailing wage, that sort of thing. They're a big stakeholder in this whole arena, and states that have been successful and countries that have been successful actually have strong support from the labor community for PPPs. The ones that haven't done it right have gotten a lot of friction around that set of issues, so that would be important to address as well. And then just the ongoing accountability for performance. The idea, you know, of course the idea is building the facility, but then from there, you know, if the private entity is going to operate the facility, that's again the Chicago Skyway issue, making sure that it's being maintained to adequate standards for safety and capacity and good function and all of that. That ongoing accountability around performance over time is an important provision. So those are my comments to the state government committee as they take a look at this idea.
For only briefly looking at this and thinking about it, I'm glad we didn't give you a couple of hours to look at the building. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Great insight, you know, and the experience that you share from your involvement in these other entities is going to be very helpful as this moves forward. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments or questions?
Oh,
Mr. Warkey.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Warkey. I represent the Associated General Contractors. At the risk of being repetitive, I am not going to. My comments are going to be just very brief. We are very supportive of P3, public-private partnership concept. I think the caveats have been well established here already, that the additional funds or the additional revenue be additive to MnDOT's program and not attract additional resources from the program. Plus, the other thing that I think Senator Peterson has allayed us our concerns of, that the contractors that are used in the construction of these P3 facilities have an opportunity to compete competitively, and that they're not being an exclusive arrangement for the financing entity to also exclusively do the construction work, et cetera. I may want to point one thing out to the committee, and at the risk of not having shared this with Senator Peterson, you may want to consider going forward on page 3, line 3.4, that when the list is provided there of the things that the commissioner should consider, that the May clause might you might want to consider having that become something stronger, like a must or something of that nature. It would give us a little more comfort as contractors that in working with the department, those things that are listed would be required things that be addressed rather than permissive. So those are my comments, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkie. Something for the State Gov Committee to also take into consideration, Senator Peterson. Do you have a comment, Senator Perry?
Actually, I'd just soon move the Senate File 2243 be recommended to pass, re-referred to Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans.
Senator Perry has moved that Senate File 2243 be recommended to pass. He re-referred to the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans. Any further discussion? Anybody in the audience wishes to testify for or in opposition to this bill? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Next up is Senator Hall, Senate File 2230.
This isn't your area, is it? Is your area?
It's close to my area. Close to both.
I like this bill. That's exactly right. St. Paul.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I bring to you today Senate File 2230, a bill to change the speed limit on 35E from 45 to 50. I know of no other interstate in the United States that has a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit for it. However, this interstate was built for a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit, and the Department of Transportation in Washington State has stated in a report in 205 that a 10-mile-an-hour reduction in speed is usually what is necessary for a noticeable increase in noise level. I have no testifiers with me today. I thought about, as I came today, about announcing it to all those thousands of drivers that drive Interstate 35 along with myself and ask if any of them would like to follow me here that would be interested in protesting or being a part of my testimony. I didn't do that because I think this is common sense enough for us to move this on. Every time I've gone to a group, and I've gone to many, either this has been brought up or I bring it up. And I ask people, what do you think of driving into St. Paul and having to slow down to 45 miles an hour? And I get a lot of groans. I actually think it's a black eye for St. Paul. And I think St. Paul themselves would like to change this if they thought they could. I'm sure some areas would not. Those residents in the area would not. The settlement agreement that held this to 45 for the last 28 years was entered into and signed by Judge Magnuson in U.S. District Court and the residents in protest. It was dated May of 1984. I believe it's time that we recognize and give credit to the fact that our cars are quieter, our tires are quieter, there are new laws regulating car maintenance, and there are a lot of other factors that make this contributing factor that the noise level is different than it was 28 years ago. We have quieter vehicles. They bring about a substantial reduction in traffic noise along the roads where no other noise-reducing measures are possible. The state and local government have passed ordinances and laws requiring existing vehicles to be properly maintained and operated. New vehicles are made in accordance with federal guidelines to meet those regulations. The corporate average fuel economy standards have been enforced now since 1984, and they have changed the size and the mass of vehicles and thus affected the noise level. Smaller cars are proven quieter. Since it takes, by the Wisconsin State Department of Transportation, takes a 10-mile-an-hour increase or decrease to change the noise level, we are only looking and asking that we change it 5 miles an hour and that increase. This is an unnoticeable change to the noise level. Highway traffic noise, they say, is affected in three things. The traffic volume, which is unpredicted, to be sure. The traffic speed, deemed unchanged. And in this sense, even the noise level with 5 miles an hour. And the percent of heavy trucks, which, again, on this stretch, you cannot drive a truck above 9,000 pounds. On the basis of the challenge, the legal challenge that was put out here, I believe it is no longer valid because the challenge was on the noise level, and thus this challenge should be vacated. I have talked to the DOT, other lawyers, and my surmise is that the only way we'll know if we really can be changed is actually to challenge it. So that's what this does. It challenges the settlement that was done in 1984. I stand for questions.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hall. This perhaps is the only highway in Minnesota where people intentionally break the law. I mean, I've been on that highway, and it's a shock. I just cannot believe that it's only 45 miles an hour. I'm not there all the time, but if I take that route to the Capitol, it's like, it makes no sense to me. So I hope you can get done what you want to get done here. It's just common sense. I think we're trying to do that at the Capitol here, and thank you for bringing it forward. Mm-hmm.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm glad the spirit of Dick Day is still with us. appreciate this annual discussion that we have. I feel honor and duty bound to stand up for the folks arrayed along that stretch of highway who worked hard to
accommodate a major interstate right through the heart of their neighborhood and made a lot of accommodations and got this one concession because of the impact on their quality of life in the neighborhood where they live. And, you know, it was the function of a great deal of wrangling and a lawsuit and the like. And I appreciate that cars perhaps are getting quieter, but, you know, they're not quiet. And there's tremendous impact. Particularly, you know, that's kind of a little valley there, and the sound just kind of moves right on up the hill. And it's, if you ever spent any time in that neighborhood along that hill, you know what the impact, the noise impact is, and it can't be addressed, it can't be mitigated by physical barriers.
Any other comments? Questions? Senator Scherr.
Did you say, Senator, that you have or have not talked with the mayor and the city council in St. Paul, and do they have a letter of support, or have they taken a position on this?
Have
had
not,
an opportunity?
I have not talked to them.
Senator Hall.
No.
Thank you. And Senator,
I do have bipartisan support,
Senator
though.
Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll regain composure here. Okay. Senator Hall.
I was saying, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, that we have talked to the DOT, and they do not take a position, but their feeling was that we cannot break the settlement. My question was, if we have Hummer cars in 10 years, there's no noise, can we break the settlement? Their feeling was not. Other legal advice that I've got said the only way you'll know for sure is to challenge it, and so that's why we're doing it. Yes.
Senator Scherr?
Well, my question is about the St. Paul City Council is that I really think it would be okay to go ahead and do this and maybe set aside the position of the St. Paul Mayor and City Council if you had enough merit statewide in terms of changing this, but to go ahead and do it without offering them the opportunity to have a reaction to what's being proposed is difficult for me to support.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I will certainly, if we pass this bill on, before it gets to the floor, talk to them and get a response from them.
Senator Hall, our intention is to hold this bill over for possible inclusion.
Okay.
And so if you could get any additional testimony and make that available to the committee, we'll be sure to get that distributed to everybody so that they know in advance of the continuing on. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, may I let the committee also know that we have bipartisan support. As you look at the authors, Senator Metzen is one of the supporters of this bill.
I understand that there's somebody from MnDOT that may be wanting to testify. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Chair. Again, Scott Peterson, the Government Affairs Office at MnDOT. Yeah, this legislation, if passed, would put us, the department, in a very uncomfortable position of having two legal obligations that are in conflict. And as a result, you know, we do have concerns about this bill moving forward. Whenever there's a highway improvement of this nature where highways are built on new right-of-way, new alignment through existing neighborhoods, there's a balance that we have to strike between the needs of the regional traffic, the traveling public, and the adjacent neighborhoods. And in this case, there was a very kind of a hard-fought struggle over what the right balance should be in this case, and the result was the court-sanctioned agreement to which Senator Hall referred that limits the speed limit on that section of 35E to 45 miles an hour. The limit of 45 miles an hour was part of the final environmental impact statement, which identified this or confirmed this as the preferred alternative and allowed the road to be built. And there are questions over whether that would the environmental impact statement would have to be reopened and reevaluated if the speed limit were changed. And there are also things such as the federal funds that went along that came with this project that paid for the largest share of the construction of the project, and what FHWA's response to legislation like this might be, since they were also signatories to this agreement. And finally, we do think that this probably will prompt a legal challenge from the neighborhood group that originally challenged the construction of the 35E and that are also a part of this agreement. So, for those reasons, I guess, we would just like to put those on the table for the committee's consideration.
Thank you for that. Any other questions? Senator Sharon.
Is there in what you're describing there as the barriers to success because of court challenge, are the members of the agreement that came to the table that mediated this agreement, if they all agreed to a change, do you think that would resolve the issue of a court hearing?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, I would suspect if there was, if all the interested parties agreed that it was no longer necessary to adhere to this agreement, then there a way could be found to reach a different agreement. Yeah.
Senator Sharon?
And has there been an effort to do that rather than just bring a legislation to the legislature? Do you know? Maybe, Senator, you have made that effort. I don't know, but in the past. No. We've had this discussion before, if there's really been a deliberate effort to try to bring the parties together for a conversation.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, we haven't done that aspect of it. We've checked to see if they're still alive, and most of them still are alive and still living in the area in their 80s and 90s. So, no, we haven't done that yet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. And Senator Hall, will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Mr. Chair and members.
Next up is Senator Hall, Senate File 2273. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I have Senate File 2273, which is an expansion of junk vehicle eligible buyers. And what it seeks to do is it seeks to add a licensed scrap metal processor to the eligible list of people who can buy these junk vehicles. I do have an amendment, but I think what I'd prefer to do, Mr. Chair, is maybe we can talk about the bill, and then I can raise a concern that I had with a repealer section of this bill. And I'll leave it up to the committee to decide. I can, I've got a concern that I had Senate Counsel draft an amendment to that would address my concern, but I think I'll leave it up to the committee to decide whether my concerns are valid or not. And, I've reached out to the Department of Public Safety and also to the supporters of this bill, and I think we'll just leave the committee to decide which way they want to go on that committee. So I do have a testifier here, Mr. Chair, okay. David Collar from the automobile auction. If he could speak to this bill, that'd be great.
Certainly. Mr. Crowder, welcome to the
Thank committee. You, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Dave Crowder, and I'm the General Branch Manager of Insurance Auto Auctions here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have to try to shed some light on this bill and hopefully answer any concerns and questions for you.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Tennyson, welcome to the committee. Sorry.
Thank you. I'll offer to walk through the bill a little bit and tell you exactly what it does and why we're doing this. Insurance Auto Auctions is a licensed salvage pool company in the state of Minnesota, and the law regulates to whom they may sell salvage vehicles. They take vehicles on consignment from insurance companies, for example, and they auction them off. The title is in the insurance company, and they can only sell to licensed purchasers. Right now, they're restricted to licensed used parts dealers, and we want to expand that to include scrap metal, licensed scrap metal processors as well. And here's why. For example, when the Katrina hurricane hit, thousands of cars were destroyed, and they were contaminated, and the insurance companies did not want any parts of those cars to be back in the market. They just wanted them scrapped, crushed. Under Minnesota, we couldn't take those cars and sell them to a scrap metal processor. We would have to sell them to a used parts dealer who then could in turn sell them, and that's sort of silly. The second part of the bill is important, and the part that Senator Howell referred to a little bit about the repeal of the regulation. There's a regulation that's been on the books a long time, and it restricts the sale of to license scrap metal processors licensed by Minnesota. That was a rule that people didn't know about for several years, and it wasn't enforced until my client about a year ago, I guess, discovered it and brought it to everybody's attention. There's no good reason why it should be restricted to Minnesota purchasers, licensed purchasers, and the department agrees with that. So that would open up the market a bit for additional buyers of these vehicles and also increase, hopefully, the amount that's recovered. The other part of the bill, which really expands authority, is the new and used car dealers may also buy scrap parts for scrap metal processing if they have a scrap metal license. And the drivers or the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association is comfortable with that as well. The Insurance Federation has informed me that they support this bill. I know of no opposition to it. And I recognize Senator Howell's concern about the possible opening up and having some untoward consequences, and that's something the committee should consider. I think I don't want to get the committee down in the weeds too much, but we could go into how this system works and how Insurance Auto Auctions in Minnesota and their competitors operate, because they have databases. They have a certain limited number of people who can buy, or companies that are licensed to buy these types of vehicles. And I think it's pretty well controlled. There's also a federal law that deals with the issue. It's called VITAS, and it requires salvage pools and a lot of other people to report to the federal government on a monthly basis the vehicles that they've taken possession of and who the owner was, and then when they're disposed of. So it isn't likely that there's going to be leakage out of the system, but there it's an issue that can be discussed. And Mr. Crowder could take you into the details and weeds of how this process works if you really want to, but I don't think you need to.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if you look at the sheet that I just had handed out, there is the holding vehicle for consignment. It's the Minnesota Administrative Rules. And the concern is on the repealer. And what the proposed amendment would propose to do is, instead of completely repealing Subdivision 3, where it says selling junk vehicles, what it would do, what it would just remove the two words from Subdivision 3 from Minnesota. So that would make that you could do it, you could sell it wherever. And it would add in, it would allow a licensed scrap metal processor to that. And the only concern is what that Subdivision 3 says is that they must verify the purchaser holds a used vehicle parts license or scrap metal processing license. And so the people that we have in Minnesota right now, I think there's five places that do this, they have everything computerized. They know whose license is valid, whose isn't, when it expires. If we completely remove that, there could be a concern that maybe down the road somebody isn't verifying this, or that we might get a situation where a vehicle might slip through the cracks and end up in a state where it doesn't get scrapped, or it doesn't get it doesn't have that junk title on it. It might get washed. So I'll leave it up to the committee to decide. Ms. Berezovsky drafted a amendment. Do we have that? Is that handed out? Let's hand that out. And I'll let the committee decide, in your best judgment, whether we should add the amendment or whether we should just totally repeal Subdivision 3.
All right, we'll wait for that to come around. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Tennyson or Crowder, should say Senator Tennyson, would this amendment significantly impair your goals?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, our members of the committee, no. What the rule does is, and what the Senator Howe has proposed, results in the same, the result's the same whether it's in the bill repealing the rule or doing it the way he wants or suggests. We still achieve the goal of expanding the market for these products to licensed buyers from other states.
Committee, I look to the committee. I don't know if I can offer an amendment as the chair.
I can offer the amendment. I just wanted to, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to sense the committee out on it. If it makes sense to leave that subdivision 3 in there, it really has to do with selling vehicles on consignment, and it makes a modification. Maybe, Mr. Chair, you could have Senate Counsel, Ms. Berezovsky, speak to it. Berezovsky.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senators, there are essentially two parts to the rule change that's proposed in the A1 amendment. First, the amendment deletes the repealer that's in the bill, and then instead it calls for a rule change that would take out the from Minnesota language, and that deals with where the used vehicle parts dealer's license was issued. And it also then would allow the dealer to sell the junked vehicle to licensed scrap metal processors, which seem to be consistent with the goals of the rest of the bill.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved the A1 amendment. Senator Lurie.
Quick, I don't know as I've ever seen us actually change the words of rules in statute. Is that something we do very often? I'm just a question for counsel procedurally. Maybe we do. I don't know.
Senator Lurie, I know we have the authority to do that. I don't know if I've... I've seen us goof around with the rules before. I don't know if we've actually dove in and changed the actual wording of rules, but I'm pretty sure we have the authority. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, this doesn't actually specifically amend the rule. It just directs the commissioner as to what to do, and that's really what the statutes do when the legislature gives rulemaking authority. It's directing the commissioner. It can be narrower or broader authority, but this is certainly it's telling what the change should be, and it also prescribes for the most expedited process so that since the commissioner just would have to follow the legislature's direction, there wouldn't be a need for a lot of hearings and that sort of thing.
I mean, I'm not challenging the A1. I'm just curious about the process. I mean, so.
All right. Any other questions? On the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Amendment passes. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate File 2273 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Senate floor.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, committee? Favor of the Howe amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. All if there's anyone else who wanted to testify.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else who wanted to testify after the fact? Good. Thanks. Moving on, Senator DeCryf.
Senator Kreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I have a bill that would establish a motorcycle license plate that would be a Start Seeing Motorcycles special plate. And it's Senate File 1226. And I do have an amendment that I'd like to move, an A1 amendment.
All right, do we have the A1 amendment?
While it's being handed out, should I just go through the bill?
Go ahead.
Okay. Section 1, Subdivision 1, directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to issue a special Start Seeing Motorcycles plate to registered owners of passenger automobiles, one-ton pickup trucks, motorcycles, or recreational vehicles for a $10 fee and a minimum $10 annual contribution to the Motorcycle Safety Fund. Subdivision 2 requires a commissioner to design the special plate after consultation with American Bikers Awareness, or ABATE, if you will. The plate must show the inscription Start Seeing Motorcycles. Subdivision 3 allows transfer of special plates for a fee of $5 to another vehicle registered to the owner of the plates. Subdivision 4 exempts these plates from statutory requirements for issuance of new special plates, which includes submission to the commissioner of a scientific sample survey showing at least 10,000 vehicle owners will purchase the plate and make contributions and payments of $20,000 application fee along with marketing plan. And Subdivision 5 directs the $10 plate and $5 fee to the vehicle services operation account in the special revenue fund.
Senator DeKreif, do you want to move the A1 amendment and speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Would you like to explain the A1 first? Or you want Senate Counsel to?
Yeah, why don't we, if we could, please have Senate Counsel maybe explain it.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, the most of this amendment is a result of suggestions of the department. In terms of eligibility for the plate, it inserts the word non-commercial when describing a one-ton pickup truck. So commercial pickup trucks would not be eligible for the plate. At the design of the plate, instead of the commissioner designing it, the group ABATE representatives will design it with, and then the commissioner has to approve of the design. And on 1.6 and 1.7 of the amendment, there are specifications for that plate. Let's see, on 121 and 122 on plate transfer, it specifies that the owner who first qualified for the plates must be the registered owner of the vehicle to which the plates are transferred.
Members, any? Go ahead.
The last thing is just that on 1.16, people who obtain the plate can't get a refund for their contributions, and it changes the effective date to 2013 from 2012.
Members, any discussion on the A1? Senator DeKreif moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify
aye.
By saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. A1 is adopted. Senator DeKreif, to your bill.
I believe that this is a very good bill. It's the motorcycle community really doesn't have any special plates, and it with the money going to the safety fund, I believe that this is a very good move in that direction to especially train new motorcyclists how to ride. And I do have a witness here. I would ask Mac,
Mr. Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Mac Backlund. I'm the state coordinator for ABATE of Minnesota. ABATE is an acronym for American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education. And we are the largest motorcycling advocacy group in the state of Minnesota. Just as some background, we have a 25-year history of bringing common sense solutions to the table We do a Share the Road program in which our volunteers go into the driver's training classes and spend anywhere up to 2 hours during their class to instruct these 15-year-olds when they're taking their driver's training the importance of watching out for other members of the transit mix on the roads, including motorcycles. We also have a Dial-A-Ride was a program that was started as an ABATE of Minnesota committee, and it was spun off into its own organization as head, and has received numerous awards nationwide for its beneficial purpose there. So again, we believe this is a good common sense bill that will get the message out of awareness, and unlike many other specialty license plates, these plates do have that awareness reinforcement message for other users of the road. We believe it would be a subtle reminder to pay attention while driving and operating your vehicle on all the roads and highways of our state. And again, it's a positive message. And with the advancements in motorcycle license or in all license plate technology, the costs are minimal. The costs are covered in the bill. And as Senator DeCrave said, there's also a donation to the Motorcycle Safety Program, which the majority of funds are used for motorcycle training and awareness campaigns and those kind of things. So, Mr. Chairman and Senators, I just ask, in the name of ABATE of Minnesota, that all of you vote yes on SF 1226.
Members, any questions for Mr. Backlund? Senator Sabin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Backlund. I appreciate, Senator DeCrave, that you bring the bill forward. I just have to point out that putting the word "start seeing motorcycle" between the bolt holes on a motorcycle plate, it's going to be really hard to see that. So, on a regular license plate, it makes more sense, but on a little motorcycle plate, it seems kind of tough. What comments do you have about that?
Senator DeCrave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sieben, actually, I had a conversation with Mr. Backlund a little earlier that, you know, they may come up with a specific color, too. There's other license plates that are unique colors, and this one potentially could be, which would also help identify it as such a plate. So there are requirements that they have to follow in order to design this plate, and I think if they do that, what it would do is they could make it unique enough that even on a motorcycle they would see it.
Could I add something else?
Mr. Backlund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sieben, also in that A1 amendment, it speaks to a design on the left-hand side of the license plate that would be larger and more noticeable. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Senator DeCrae.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to mention one other thing, that if you see the motorcycle, and if you're looking at the motorcycle plate, the object of having the motorcycles especially included in this is there's a $10 donation from everyone that rides a motorcycle towards safety training. And that's specifically why I really like the idea of the motorcycles themselves being able to buy this plate. Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to move that Senate File 1226 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Committee on Finance.
Senator DeCrive moves that Senate File 1226 be recommended to pass as amendment and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dibble.
There's so many that are not used.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee, I bring you Senate File 2251, which is a bill to adjust State Patrol escort service rates as well as agency rates for aircraft services. Before we start, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment just to get some dates and some language.
straightened out a little bit. A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Do we have the A2 amendment? Senator Dibble, would you like to speak to the A2 amendment, or do you want Senate counsel?
I'll ask Senate counsel. It was a Senate counsel catch.
Ms. Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair, this is really a technical amendment, and it just updates the dates in the bill and makes some grammatical changes. It was initiated in the House, and it seemed appropriate to put it on the bill in the Senate as well.
Members, any questions to the A2 amendment? Senator Dibble moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So very quickly, these rates that are charged, these fees that are charged for State Patrol escort services have not been increased for a few years. Captain Urquhart will, or Major Urquhart will remind us how long it's been. I forgot. It increases the fees to a set amount and then allows for, after 2014, allows the fees to be reviewed and adjusted by the commissioner based on the costs that are provided. The fees charged for State Patrol flight services have not been increased for some time, and so it has a similar provision to that end for use of the state aircraft or the state helicopter. Major Urquhart is here to help us understand
Major
the bill a little better.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Urquhart. I'm the Major with the State Patrol. Mr. Chairman, members, the last time these rates were examined by the legislature was in year 2007, and the rate was adjusted for fiscal year 2008 and 2009. And subsequently, of course, fees or costs go up, fuel, equipment, personnel costs, maintenance. And when we're approached to provide services, and some of these services include traffic direction, traffic enforcement duties, MinPass enforcement, oversized load escorts, financial institution closures, specialized training, and then aircraft services to a wide range of partners, such as the counties for transporting prisoners, Department of Corrections. We provide emergency services to the DNR during forest fires, rescue services, photography flights for the Department of Transportation, and so forth.
Questions, members? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dibble, or testifier, at lines 1.17 to 1.21, looks like some of the rates are going up and some of them are going down. If I look at the Queen Air, for example, that one is 600 but down to 454. Is it basically based on the true cost? Is that what I see here?
Major?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, to my knowledge, the reason that rate went down on the Queen Air was during the 2007, our agency had just put two brand new engines in that aircraft, so we had to, through our fiscal folks, we had to depreciate the value of that aircraft with the additional cost of new aircraft engines, and they're not cheap. So at that time, it was $600, and now, subsequently, a number of years later, through the depreciation, we can reduce that cost.
Thank you.
Senator DeCreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce the A3 amendment.
Senator DeCreif is introducing the A3 amendment. We'll have that passed out. Senator DeCreif, to your amendment.
To the amendment, Mr. Chair. What I was basically doing is not changing at all the fee structure going up, but deleting the, I think there's three different sentences essentially here that say, and thereafter the fees may be reviewed and adjusted by the commissioner a public safety in an amount equal to the cost of providing this service. I guess I would prefer that that was left out and that the legislature could review this again if they needed to in a few years, as opposed to just leaving it in the hands of the commissioner.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, heard a rumor that this amendment might be coming. I didn't know who or what. I understand offering amendments without talking to authors ahead of time. I sometimes do that myself.
Well, Senator Dibble, I did not know it was coming.
But you know, sometimes it does help to talk. Maybe the chief author would consider an idea like this. This is an agency initiative. I'm sure the agency probably has some feeling about this. I would just suggest that sometimes we do want to have the opportunity to set fees like this in stone, and then the legislature just has the authority, and we don't delegate to the agency or the executive branch their ability to index these things. I think big news at the top of the hour this morning was hunting and licensing fees going on in another committee in the Senate today. So I understand the legislature's desire to have fairly specific control over these sorts of things that our citizens pay. But as such, I do think that there is a fairly good and strong language in the bill already. It says, in an amount equal to the cost of providing this service. And we see, nice catch from Senator Gazelka, that in at least two instances down in the flight services, two of the fees are actually going down. And so we see some responsible action on the part of the agency. So, Mr. Chair, I would resist the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Is there anybody, Major, would you like to speak to this, or is there anybody from the agent that would like to speak? Major?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Members, roughly we contract about 35,000 hours a year on the average. And, of course, just based on the first change there for a trooper in a vehicle, that's at the least about $125,000 of lost rates that we're suffering as we speak here. So, our concern was the last time this was visited was in 2007 by the legislature. And, of course, a number of years have passed since we were able to do that again. And we just, as an agency, don't want to see those kinds of losses year after year. And that's why we were concerned and wanted that additional language.
Members, any more discussion on the A3? Senator DeCryf renews his motion on the A3 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No. No.
Motion carries. The A3 is adopted. Senator Dibble, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll look to the committee administrator. Do we need to go to finance? Yep.
We're laying over.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that we lay Senate file 2251 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Senator Dibble, we will do that. We will lay over Senate file 2251 without objection for possible inclusion in the Senate in the transportation omnibus bill policy bill. Committee members, we are going to recess until 4:30 p.m. and reconvene in room 112. At that time, we will take up the omnibus transportation policy bill number 2. It will be just a walkthrough, and we won't be taking any action tonight. We'll stand in recess.